You're listening to Baseline from 538.
You're listening to Baseline from 538.
You're listening to Baseline from 538.
You're listening to Baseline from 548.
538.
Damn it!
538.
Hi, this is Carl Bialik from 538. Welcome back to Baseline, the podcast that we're recording live at the U.S. Open throughout the tournament. I'm really excited to welcome our guest for today's episode, Chris Evert, my ESPN colleague and also the winner of 18 major singles titles and 3 doubles titles.
Correct.
Thanks for joining us, Chris.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
So 538 is forecasting this tournament. We have forecasts for the men's draw and the women's draw for every match.
Okay.
What probability would you give to Serena Williams winning the title as we sit here before heading into the quarterfinals?
I would give her about a 80% probability.
Very bullish high on Serena Williams.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
What about Djokovic?
I would give him 60%.
Okay. You're not far off from what we're saying using just our ratings, our ELO ratings. We give Serena Williams a 61%. We're a little more concerned about Halep and Kerber. And then we give Djokovic a 66% chance, but we aren't really directly taking into account that he skipped Cincinnati, that he looked a little shaky in that first match.
You know, after thinking about it, I probably was a little overambitious with Serena, but no, I have to stick with it. I think I'm going to stick with it, 80% and 60%.
Okay. Yeah. Certainly, one thing we're not taking into account these ratings is just how dominant she's been so far. She's, I don't think she's lost more than 3 games in a set. She hasn't been broken. She's faced 1 break point. Are you seeing it in the match, or is it the level of opponents?
I'm seeing that her shoulder's feeling better. I mean, I've always said that if Serena Williams is healthy and motivated and comes with her A game, nobody can beat her. So far, she's healthy and she's motivated, and she's very focused. It doesn't seem to feel the pressure like she did last year. So she's just playing some clean matches without a lot of errors. But that's not to say the field, if somebody gets hot on their day, couldn't beat her, because that's very possible too.
Do you feel at all like you're part of a club that she is a member of too, that you have 18, Martina Navratilova won 18 in singles, she's got 22, she's looking to break Steffi Graf's record with 22. Is there some kind of bond you feel with players like that over doing something almost nobody else has done?
Yeah, I think so. I think that for a long time it was Steffi. First of all, Margaret Court, even though she won a lot of hers, not in the open era, in the amateur days, but with Margaret Court and Steffi Graf and Martina and for a long time that was the kind of the group in the club. And then all of a sudden Serena has, in the last 2 years, just ripped everything open, and she's just come on strong, and she's going to for sure pass Steffi Graf, because even if she doesn't win it this year, you have a feeling that next year she can at least win one. I do. I feel it's a very it's a club that is very, how can I say it? It's sort of iconic, and it's sort of a club that not very many people are in, and you have to have a champion mentality to be in that club as well as a champion game.
Did you feel when you were playing like there was this kind of focus that we have now in the tennis media about the major count? Did you know where you stood relative to history, and was that a big goal for you?
No, it's so different now. Now all the players' goals are not necessarily to win tournaments. Who's going to have the best year? Who's going to end up number one? It's all about Grand Slams, and it's all about records and history. And we didn't have that in our day, because when I was brought up in the 70s with Billie Jean King and Martina, I mean, we were, our goal was really to build a tour and to build the WTA and to build, at that time it was Virginia Slims. And so we were very serious about every single week and every single tournament that we played. And we weren't as concerned with numbers of Grand Slams, because there are so many Australians that I didn't play because it was during Christmas. And there's French Opens that I didn't play because it was during World Team Tennis, you know. So We were more concerned with the overall pictures of who's going to be number one, how many tournaments did you win this year, and then also how many Grand Slams. But they were not the focus. And I think with social media, I think that it's also helped for the Grand Slams to become huge now.
You mentioned that you didn't play a lot of Australian Opens. I looked and it looked like you probably skipped it about a dozen times and instead enjoyed your Christmas without playing tennis. And all six times you did play, you made the final. So you clearly could have won a bunch more. Do you ever regret it? Ever think, oh, I could have 25?
No, but I also am in the position where firsthand I don't put too much emphasis on, well, who's leading the race for Grand Slams, because I know that those 3 years I missed the French, I was the best clay court player. I probably could have added some more Grand Slams. I know that Monica Seles, when she got stabbed, she was number one in the world, and she could have won definitely another, you know, five or six Grand Slams. So, I mean, there's just a lot of different scenarios that could have happened, but, you know, nobody sort of remembers those scenarios, and they're stuck on the numbers.
Speaking of the numbers, you talked about what the benchmarks were in your day, including who's number one and who's having the best year and so on. Nowadays, it seems like players mostly try to deny caring about them until at least they achieve them. So Serena Williams did make a big deal about setting the record for the most match wins at Grand Slam. She just won her 308th, which passed Roger Federer. But last year, she didn't want to talk about the Grand Slam, and Kerber kind of tries to downplay that she could overtake Serena Williams for number one at this tournament. Did you pay attention to those sorts of benchmarks, like being number one? And if you did, were you honest with the media about it, or did you play it off as, no, I just care about the next match and the next opponent?
I was conscious of being number one, but at the same time, you know, I understand why they answer the way they do, because they don't want to put pressure on themselves. They don't want to think about it. And I think if you're in that position, you don't want to have to think about it and have to answer that question every single day at a press conference. If they would ask it once a tournament, that's one thing, but it gets repetitious, and then you start to feel expectations and pressure from other people, and you just don't feel as relaxed. So I understand 100% why they don't want to answer it. But at the end of the day, you're still thinking about it as a player for sure.
How much did it weigh on your mind? I think 14 times you and Martina traded number one. One of you took it from the other. Was that a big factor in your scheduling and in playing each other? Was that in your mind? Like, I really want to get that number one ranking back or protect it from her taking it.
You know, when I was on tour with Martina, when she was number one, she was dominating me for 2.5 years where I didn't win a match from her. So I would pray that I didn't have to play her. So I really, you know, was human, and I was intimidated, and she was just a better player, more powerful. And I walked down the court, and I knew I was going to lose against her for those 2.5 years. But towards the end, I think when we were pretty even, you know, I was starting to win some French Opens, and she was, and we were having close matches at the U.S. Open on hard courts. Then I was more excited, I think, because I was more mature and I could accept the fact that if I played my best, I could accept winning or losing. But we had an up and down, really, relationship during our rivalry. We didn't always get along well. I mean, there are sometimes we weren't getting along well, and other times we were close and appreciated each other. But if I didn't have Martina in my era, I wouldn't have played till I was 34 years old, and I wouldn't have been the player that I ended up being.
You mentioned how important it was to have her, have a rival like that. What do you think is driving Serena Williams at this point? If you look at this draw here, the only two women, I think, who have been number one and won more than one major who are even in the draw are her and her sister. And they're both, Serena's 34 years old, Venus is 36. Do you think it's hard for her to find that motivation? And if not, where do you think she's finding it?
You know, I think it's easier when you have a rival like I did with Martina, who sort of, you know, beat you a few times, and then you work harder and you get to that next level. But Serena's rival is herself, really, and that makes it more difficult, I think, to get that inspiration, to get that motivation. So I think it does get tough for her. But right now she's chasing records and she's chasing history. She's not necessarily chasing a player. So I think that in itself If you have that motivation and you know you're going to go down the history books as the greatest of all time because you win 23 Grand Slams, I think that in itself is enough motivation. It doesn't need to be a player at this point.
The game has become so global, and yet there isn't really someone who's been consistent in that next generation or the one after that. Why do you think that is? Does that surprise you that there still seems to be this big gulf between Serena Williams, who turns 35 later this month, and everybody else?
It doesn't surprise me because she is one in a million. She's a phenomenal athlete. She has brought a new level of power to tennis that we've never seen before. She covers the court like a gazelle. You know, she's so quick around the court. I mean, this is a champion who has everything and who has the mental and emotional aspects also. There are no weaknesses in her game, and she's just a better athlete than everybody else. And so it doesn't surprise me. She's a level ahead. But I feel that the more she's in the game, the more the players are slightly starting to get it and put more strategy in when they play her and kind of reaching up to her level a little bit more, not being as intimidated with her like a Kerber or a Muguruza did this year. So, you know, I think the gap is closing slowly. But they better hurry up because she's 34 years old.
Yeah. One of the great things about tennis is how the generations can be bridged, how a player near the end of their career can play a young player. You beat Monica Seles here in your last mm-hmm. major, and that was to reach a quarterfinal, and you beat her pretty soundly. Mm-hmm. And then from that point on, she hardly lost a match at a Grand mm-hmm. Slam for a few years. What was that like? How does that help inform you about the game? And do you think in general also that the game is stronger now than it was when you were playing because of how more global it was? Or do you feel like you and Martina could compete, you know, if you were born in 1981, let's say?
I think a champion is a champion. I think if Suzanne Langland was born in this generation, she would probably be up there in the top five, or Maureen Conley, or, you know, because the mental part of the game is 50%, if not more, than the physical part of the game. Do I think the standard is higher? I think the standard is higher because of the new equipment and the new training methods, and every sport gets better. You know, I mean, you look at Mark Spitz, who won 7 gold medals as a swimmer, and 10 years later, the women were breaking his record, the women swimmers. So, I mean, it's human nature that every sport gets to be a higher level. I kind of question, like, the top four players. Like, in our era, we had Martina and I, and then Manlikova, then we had Martina and I, and then Groff and Seles. And at the top, I don't feel it's as close, but I think depth-wise, you know, the number 100 player on a given day can beat a top five player, and that never happened in my day. So
and that
you're
happened
right.
last night.
That happened last night. So worldwide, there's, you know, globally, there's much more depth, no doubt about it. But at the top, I think there have been other eras that have had, you know, with the Capriotis and the Ennens and Kleisters and, you know, Lindsay Davenports. I mean, you had some higher-ranked players that would threaten the number one player a lot more. That is to say, and I don't know if that's saying that the top of the field isn't as strong or that Serena Williams is just that much better. I mean, that's the other way you can look at it also.
Yeah, although sometimes those other top players lose before they even reach her. So we had last night Anna Kanye, who beat Radwanska, who had an outside
Muguruza.
Shot at number one. Muguruza lost in the second round.
Well, our number three and number four and number five players in our day were more dependable and more consistent than the players of today.
Which could, I guess, make the early rounds of majors pretty predictable, but the late rounds fantastic.
Second week is unpredictable. Yeah.
So I wanted to ask about a letter that you wrote to Serena Williams 10 mm-hmm. years ago. Now, mm-hmm. you now have your own apparel line, but she's been in that field even as she's been a tennis player and sort of balancing those two. And 10 years ago, you wrote to her to basically ask her, are you balancing these things correctly? Are you thinking enough about your place in history? And now she's still playing. She's tied Steffi Graf. She's won 9 majors since 30. Do you think maybe some of her time away from tennis maybe helped her? Or do you feel like if she had less time away from tennis, she'd be at 27 or 28 slams now?
I think that she had to do it in her own time. You know, I think when I wrote that letter, it was with good intention. Serena was in and out of the game. She wasn't in shape. I mean, it wasn't mainly like, Serena, how come you're not winning? It was like, you know, you have the potential to be the greatest of all time. And she had, this was when she had only won like 10 Grand Slams. And she had 2 or 3 years where she was in and out of the game, not in shape, getting injured, going to Hollywood parties. I mean, she was very distracted and doing a lot of other things. And my letter was, again, you may look back one day and wish that you had been more focused. Consequently, as it turns out, she had to go through that period maybe for her to get her to this stage where she can really appreciate her tennis, her place in history. And maybe she needed to be a little emotionally more mature to handle the pressure and to be a leader in the tennis world. So, I mean, it's all worked out well for her. And this is her time. After 30, she's won 9 Grand Slams. So, I mean, you could say she's a late bloomer. She was an early bloomer. Then she had really a gap in her career in the middle stages, and then she's ending up really strong.
So I wanted to just ask one thing about the men's game before we let you go. Okay. We have, according to our forecast, a 40% chance of seeing a Djokovic-Murray final. And we saw a Djokovic-Murray final at the Australian Open and at the French Open. And it kind of feels, or I want to know if it feels to you, yeah, like this is really the year finally where they have taken over among the big four. And if so, have they already, or can they kind of get that level of interest that Roger and Rafa had when they were clearly the top?
That's a tough question. I don't think anybody is more loved than Roger Federer, you know, across the globe. You know, I think he's a very, very popular champion. And the beauty of him was not only his personality, but also his game was so, like, magic. I don't know. I mean, I think it could be a great rivalry as far as intenseness and great tennis and just grinding it out and long rallies. But their games are very similar, and that's the problem, because I think a great rivalry like Martina and I, there's always a contrast. And you bring your own set of fans. You bring your own set, your own brand of tennis. You see every shot in the book when, you know. But these two are basically counterpunchers who are getting better at being aggressive, and they just run everything down, and they're very similar. So I don't know how attractive that could be in the future. But in saying that, they are the greatest players this year, just like Kerber and Serena. They've had the best record, and if they do get to the finals, it would be great, because there are still a lot of dangerous men in the field playing pretty well, but they would deserve to reach the finals, because they're the two players of the year. And, you know, again, I'd give maybe a slight edge to Djokovic, but Andy Murray, what a summer he's had.
Who'd have thunk that Paolo Lorenzi would give him the toughest match that he's had here so far?
Well, you always, I think, in a Grand Slam, everyone who wins a Grand Slam, usually they have one match where they're either sloppy or they're not into it or they're not playing well. I mean, I think that really spurs them on. I think they're a different player after that match. And sure enough, he was a different player last night. He played flawless.
Crushed Dimitra. That's right. Well, thank you so much, Chris, for being here.
Thank you very much. I'm glad we could do it.
That's it for this episode of Baseline. Thanks also to our producer, Jorge Estrada, and additional help from Jody Avergan, Tony Chow, Chadwick Matlin, Ryan Antel, and Joe Sykes. We'll be back soon with another conversation, and in the meantime, you should check out our ongoing coverage, including our constantly updating U.S. Open forecast at 538, as well as coverage on ESPN.com. And subscribe to Hot Takedown so you don't miss an episode. You can email us at podcast@538.com with any comments or suggestions. Thanks. Thank you.